Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on property is the holy grail of law right after this. You know, those who already walk submissively will say, there is no cause for alarm. But submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage, and the Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. And our Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression, of the press, of political and social activities, free from government surveillance. Now, you know, I wished I'd have thought of that statement, but that quotation actually comes from our Supreme Court, Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, to be particular. Now, you know, our princes and our politicians are bellowing in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control. And you and I have not heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth now in more than 75 years. That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes out of our courts. It doesn't come out of our political process. It doesn't come from our politicians, our lawyers, or our bureaucrats. You know, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, you give me the money power, and I care not who makes the law. Well, let me echo that by saying, you give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either. Because the real power in America, and indeed the world power in the world, is in our courts and judicial system. It's not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call us here at the law school, and we'll tell you how. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. And Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, our school, is available on compact disc now for adult home education. So if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. You just click on email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Okay, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, we're talking about property, and property being the holy grail of law. One of the things that has always fascinated me about law is the way that law has so many anomalies in it, so many different catch-22s, so many different surprises that jump right out of the woodwork when you're least expecting it. Let me give you an example. Here in America, one of the most common convictions is for owning or having possession of a machine gun. Now, I know for most people around the world, you'd say, well, who in the hell wants a machine gun? Well, for some reason here in America, a lot of people want machine guns. And so a machine gun now is one that's fully automatic. Semi-automatics are legal, and they're as common as pigs in a barnyard. Now, by modifying the gun, I don't know how to do that, but you know, there's people that modify these semi-automatics, and they make them fully automatic, so that when you pull the trigger, it just keeps firing. Now, it's against the law to have one of these fully automatic machine guns or submachine guns. All right, that's the official word on the street. Everybody knows that. Okay. Now, let me tell you, that's not true. It's just absolutely false. That's the propaganda that masquerades out there on the street. And listen, the jails are full of people who have been caught having or possessing one of these fully automatic machine guns. But here's the anomaly. I mean, here's this wild, off-the-wall, unbelievable exception to the rule. Listen to this. Every American citizen, well, with the exception of those that are specifically prohibited, like felons, but, you know, just normal Joe Sixpack citizens, every American citizen can own, possess, and have a fully automatic machine gun. That's right, as a matter of law. But there's a little caveat that goes with that that seemingly nobody knows, and here's what it is. In order for you to have one of these fully automatic machine guns, you must have a commercial license, and the commercial license comes from the Internal Revenue Service. You have to go to the IRS and pay them $235. That was the last number I saw. It may be more or less than that now, but it used to be $235, and they'll give you a license so that you can have a fully automatic machine gun. And that applies to every American. I mean, old ladies 85 years old in a nursing home with $235 could walk down to the IRS to pay them. And it's actually not a license. It's called a tax stamp. Tax stamp. It's commercial. You see, the ownership of a gun, of a fully automatic gun, in this country is predicated upon a commercial tax stamp. Now, don't ask me why it is that all these people out here that want these fully automatic guns, surely they must have $235. Hell, the gun costs $1,000. I would say that if you got $1,000 to go out and buy one of these guns, you ought to have another $235 to go down and pay for the tax stamp. But they don't. Or else they don't know about it. Maybe that's what it is. Now, that's what I mentioned to you last time. See, what we're dealing with here is commerce versus property. Commerce versus property. Now, listen to this story. Here's a case that comes out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It deals with one of these automatic machine guns. Listen. San Francisco, California. A federal appeals court on Thursday overturned a Mesa, Arizona man's federal conviction of possessing 5 machine guns. Okay, picture this. Here's a guy who's got 5 machine guns. Ranger Rick comes in, catches him, arrests him, and hauls him off to jail. They take him into court, they prosecute him, and they convict him. So he takes his conviction into the Court of Appeals, and he says something. We'll find out what he says here in a minute. But he says, hey, wait a minute. You should overturn my conviction on the following grounds, that my conviction was unconstitutional because. Now listen to the reason. A 3-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals of San Francisco reversed the conviction, ruling that the congressional ban does not apply to homemade machine guns and their parts because they were never in the stream of commerce. Commerce. See, you have a right to property. Remember, we talked about that last time when we were talking about sewage. Now, boys and girls, you cannot have sewage. If you go out and you buy 5 gallons of sewage and you bring it in and you stick it in your garage, and somebody finds out about that, and they report that to the police, and the police reports that to Health, Sanitation, and Welfare, and they'll send out the gendarmes, and they'll come out and arrest you and take your sewage and then prosecute you. Well, you could do the same thing with dynamite or explosives. I mean, you know, test it. You know, go buy a box of dynamite, take it in, put it in your garage, and then let the word get out in the neighborhood that you've got a box of dynamite in your garage and watch what happens. You can't do that. See, that's regulated and controlled. Now, if on the other hand you had property, if you didn't have sewage, but rather you had night soil, as we discussed last time. See, that's another story. Property is the holy grail of law. Now listen to this. If this is commercial, now commerce is not property. It's the exact opposite to property. So what government wants you to do is engage in commerce. We can regulate you. We can tax you. But if you're dealing in property, then we can't touch you. Now that's the way that game is played. Now watch this. Robert Stewart was sentenced to 5 years in prison for being a felon in possession of firearms and of possessing illegal machine guns last year. His attorney, Thomas Haney of Phoenix, said the decision doesn't mean much for his client or for the gun movement. Few people have the skills to build a weapon from scratch, as Stewart did, Haney said. Haney said most states, including Arizona, also have state bans against rapidly firing machine guns that would withstand judicial scrutiny regardless of whether the weapon was homemade. It might not be viable for anyone to think they can start making their own. Stewart, meanwhile, faces about a 20-year sentence next week after being convicted this summer of soliciting a fellow prisoner at the Federal Correctional Institution in Phoenix to kill U.S. District Judge Rosalind Silver, the judge who last year sentenced him to 5 years on the weapons violation. So the guy is probably going to stay in prison because he's trying to kill judges. Now listen, the Ten Commandments ban us from killing people, and machine guns have no other function or purpose in life than to kill people with. I can't think of any logical or rational reason for wanting a machine gun, because unless you're a killer, unless you're a murderer, unless you're a person who's intent upon killing other people, there wouldn't be any need or use for one. It's kind of like owning a hydrogen bomb. What the hell are you going to do with it? How many people would want to have a hydrogen bomb? Now, here in America, we Americans really covet and lust after, and we desire, and we're very intent upon owning nuclear weapons. But the only people that would want a nuclear weapon would be somebody that wanted to use a weapon of mass destruction to kill a lot of people. And so the only thing I can figure is Americans have it in their minds to use weapons of mass destruction to kill a lot of other people. Otherwise, what would we want them for? They don't serve any other function, do they? Can you tell me, can you write me an email and tell me what you use a 20-ton or 20-megaton nuclear or thermonuclear weapon for? What's the purpose for it? Is there any other use other than killing people, destroying cities? All right, now getting back here to the property is the holy grail of law. This is a real-life story. If you make your own machine gun. If you make your Gordon machine gun, that's legal. You can do that all day long. Or if you want a Winchester or a Ruger or a Thompson machine gun, you can do that, but you have to have the IRS tax stamp. Okay. Other than that, you know, it's illegal to have one of these weapons. The moral of the story is that it's perfectly legal as long as you stay out of commerce and stay in property. That's the moral to the story. Let's take a look at another example of property here. This is called Almeida Sanchez. Almeida Sanchez is a Mexican, and he's got a U.S. green card. He came into the United States. He's 30 or 40 miles north of the Mexican border, traveling on an east-west road, Highway 30, in California, and he's driving along at 2 o'clock in the morning, minding his own business, doing his thing. And there's a couple of Border Patrol agents sitting there in their car, and they see this pickup go through an intersection, which is well lit, and they see this guy's a Mexican. And one agent says to the other, hey, Tom, did you see what I just saw? Yeah, we saw a Mexican. Let's go stop him. So they went out and they stopped the guy, and they searched his pickup, and then they found a bunch of marijuana. I don't know how much, half a ton, something like that, a bunch of marijuana. So they arrested him and charged him with drug smuggling and one thing and another. This case winds its way up to the United States Supreme Court. And guess what? The U.S. Supreme Court cuts the guy loose. They say, hey, wait a minute. You can't interfere with this Mexican driving west on an east-west highway 30 miles north of the border and take his marijuana. Now listen, marijuana in this country is strictly illegal. And you can't grow it, and you can't transport it, and you can't sell it, and you can't buy it, and it's just absolutely against the law. Now here's our Supreme Court. You caught the guy. He had the marijuana. We've got it in the pile, and our Supreme Court turns him loose. But why? I mean, they convict people, you know, for trafficking in drugs every day of the week. Our jails are overflowing with these people. Well, what about this guy? What is it about this guy that makes him so sacrosanct? Why is this guy, who's not even a citizen, for crying out loud, why is he cut loose and turned loose? Now, they didn't give him back his marijuana. They didn't go that far. But here's a guy that should have been locked up in jail for 20 years, and so, no, he's out on the street, you know, dancing a jig and doing his thing. All right, now, listen to this story. This is very... very educational. Let's find out. The court says, in seeking a rationale for the validity of the search in this case, the government thus understandably sidesteps the automobile search cases. And, instead, the government relies heavily upon cases that deal with administrative inspections. But these cases fail to support the constitutionality of this search. See, this search was illegal. This stopping and searching this guy was illegal, and so his conviction was thrown out. Now, I'm asked about this quite often, you know, will this work in Australia? Of course it works in Australia and Canada and the Czech Republic and all over the world. What you do is you won't have a case that says Almeida Sanchez, but you'll have cases in your country that deal with this very same thing that violates the law concerning search and seizure in your country. So that's what you're looking for. And it just happens that this is one of the search and seizure cases here in the United States, okay, which violates our Constitution. There are violations of the Czech Constitution, and violation of the English Constitution and law, and violations of the Canadian Constitution, or violations of the Norwegian Constitution. Come on, let's wake up and smell some coffee here, kids. Now, our court went on to say, in camera versus municipal court, the court held that the administrative inspections to enforce community health and welfare regulations could be made on less than probable cause to believe that particular dwellings were the sites of particular violations. And yet the court insisted that the inspector obtain either consent or a warrant supported by particular physical and demographic characteristics of the areas to be searched. Now, the search in this case was conducted in the unfettered discretion of the members of the Border Patrol who did not have a warrant, did not have probable cause, and they did not have consent. Okay, so they lacked those three indicia. Now, had the guy said, oh, sure, come on in, search my pickup. Or had he done something that would have given them probable cause, sure, that would have carried the day. If they had gone to a judge and got a warrant, that would have been fine, but they didn't do any of the above. So, the search thus embodied precisely the evil that the court saw in the camera case when it insisted that the discretion of the official in the field be circumscribed by obtaining a warrant prior to the inspection. Now, oftentimes, the police act in an illegal manner. They get away with it about 99% of the time, because the average Joe Sixpack citizen simply doesn't know that the police are violating the law. They don't know how to identify, isolate, and pinpoint that violation. So police get away with it. Which is why I keep telling you, you know, God himself told you that you needed a legal education. If you had a legal education, you'd be able to do something with your life. But without a legal education, you get raped, robbed, and pillaged. And most often, you get raped, robbed, and pillaged with your consent. That's the crazy part of it. Now, the court went on to say that two other administrative inspection cases that have been relied upon by the government are equally in opposite. The government claims that Colonnade Catering Corporation versus United States and United States versus Biswell both approved warrantless inspections of commercial enterprises engaged in businesses closely regulated and licensed by the government. Well, in the Colonnade Catering Company case, the court stressed the long history of federal regulation and taxation of the manufacture and sale of liquor. In the Biswell case, the court noted the pervasive system of regulation and reporting that is imposed upon licensed gun dealers. But a central difference between those cases and this case is that businessmen who are engaged in such federally licensed and regulated enterprises accept the burdens as well as the benefits of their trade, whereas the petitioner here was not engaged in any regulated or licensed business. The businessman in a regulated industry, in effect, consents to the restrictions placed upon him. Boy, that's a mouthful. All right, so let's just take a look at where the reality of life is. So you go out here and you get a Social Security number. And then you go out here and you go to work and you're doing your thing, but you don't pay your income taxes. Uh-oh, you people are in trouble. All of you people out there that aren't paying your income tax and you have a Social Security number are in trouble because that's tax evasion. It certainly will for failure to file. Probably tax evasion in addition to it. And that's why you get into trouble. See, you've consented to income tax. The income tax here in America is voluntary. And we all recognize that, except that everybody volunteered. Nobody told you what the voluntary action was. It was when you got your Social Security account. All right, so same thing now when we take a look at commerce. When you go down and get a business license, oh, my God, you're going to have OSHA and the EPA and the State Tax Commission and all these government agencies and bureaucrats coming into your office and auditing your books and raising hell with you. I operate a law school. Nobody comes in here. Nobody audits any books. Nobody gives me any static. Nobody even pays attention to me. I run a private business. I don't have any license here. But I'm not engaged in any commerce. That's the key. I don't have any income. God, I avoid income like AIDS, herpes, and VD. I avoid commerce like it was the plague itself. So I'm not complaining, and I don't have any problems. Now, of course, most of you people are sitting out there saying, well, I want to participate in commerce. Well, okay, no problem. If you want to participate in commerce, well, then you have to obey all the rules and regulations that apply to commerce. Listen to this again. You know, as they say at the card room, you know, they say read them and weep. Listen to this. A central difference between these cases and this case is that businessmen who are engaged in such federally licensed and regulated enterprise, they accept the burdens as well as the benefits of their trade. But this marijuana trafficker was not engaged in any regulated or licensed business. Can you understand that? He's not engaged. Now, I'm not advocating that you go out here and go in the marijuana and cocaine business. That's not the point. You could do all kinds of businesses. I mean, you know, you can sell cars and houses and do all kinds of things that you want to buy, sell, and trade, and do it outside the realm of commerce. Do it under the precincts of the Ten Commandment model and property instead of doing it under the civil law modality or the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto modality of commerce. Stay the hell out of commerce. Now, the legislatures, when they enact laws, rules, and regulations, they do so with the Commerce Clause in mind. All laws here in the United States are enacted pursuant to the Commerce Clause of Article 1, Section 8, not pursuant to your right to contract under Article 1, Section 10. So you've got this inalienable right to contract that you ignore, and then you go into commerce, which is what gives you all the problems that you're trying to avoid. All right, so now with that out of the way, let's take a look at another story here. There's two real neat stories. Now, keeping in mind, we're talking about property. Now remember that property is the sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world in total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe. In the universe is a very important part to the definition. Boys and girls, the only other person in the universe is God. Well, I suppose there's a few angels out there, but you know, stop and think about this in pragmatic terms. Using the word universe to say, hey, listen, I've got a right to something to the exclusion of everybody on planet Earth, limits it here to the Earth. So I've got a right to this property, and it excludes everybody in Missouri. You know, the one that identifies Missouri. But when we say, I have a right to property that excludes everybody in Missouri or on planet Earth or in the universe, hell, I can only be talking about God himself. So if you've got this right to property, well, then God doesn't own it. And indeed, God has given you ownership of certain things, certain properties. You have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's what our Constitution spells out. And in most countries in the world, and the UN Declaration on Human Rights guarantees you these rights to life, liberty, and property. Now, in pursuit of happiness by our court here has been construed property. Property now includes corporal and incorporeal hereditaments, which are corporal, that is the wristwatch that you're wearing, or incorporeal, that is the right that you have to the use of somebody else's watch. See, you can own a watch, and you can lease it or rent it to me. And now I'm wearing the watch, and I'm telling time, and I have a property right in the watch. It's not a property right in the watch itself. It's a property right to the use of the watch. Go down and rent a car from Hertz. Then we ask the question, do you own the car? No. Do you have any rights associated with the car? Absolutely. You have a right to the use of the car. You can get in it. You can drive it. You can look in the mirror. You can raise the hood. You can put your suitcase in the trunk. So you have a right to the use of the car while you don't have any ownership in the car itself. All right, now rights. How many rights do you have? Oh, I had a judge tell me that one time. He asked me that very question. He said, hey, Gordon, how many rights do you think you have? And so he said, can you name some of them? So I'm sitting here naming rights. You know, I got a right to face, confront, and cross-examine my accusers. and I have a right to a jury trial, and I have a right to property. And I, you know, and he said, well, that's really good, Gordon. God, that's really good. I named about 10 rights or 5 rights or something like that. And he said, God, that's really good. And he said, now, how many rights do you think you have? And I thought about that for a minute, and I said, gee, Judge, I don't know. And so I asked him, I said, well, do you have a number? And he said, yeah. He said, you have about 1,100. Last time I heard a number, he said it was in law school, and you have about 1,100 rights. Wow, that's amazing. I couldn't name 1,100 rights. I haven't got a clue. Now, there's 400 maxims of law. If you look up the word maxim, M-A-X-I-M-S, maxims, those maxims are actually rights. And most of them are incorporeal rights. They're not tangible things, you know, like a wristwatch or an automobile, but they're the rights that you have that are attendant to your actions in life or the uses that you put things to in life. So just jot the number down. You have about 1,100 rights. Now, here's the kicker. Not a single one of those rights is available to you unless you can articulate and claim that right on the courtroom floor. That's the only time that this right is of any value to you. Here's an illustration. It is true that you have a right to face, confront, and cross-examine the witnesses that are being used against you. Face, confront, cross-examine witnesses. What if you don't know that? And so the government comes in, they bring in witnesses, and they testify against you, but you don't know that you have a right to face them and cross-examine them. And so when you're asked the question, the judge is going to ask you the question. Do you have any questions? And you say no. Okay. Now you have waived that right to face, confront, and cross-examine these witnesses against you. You had to know, and you had to know how to use it. You would have to know how to cross-examine somebody in the courtroom in order for you to exercise that right to face, confront, and cross-examine these witnesses. Well, if you don't know you have the right, or if you knew you had the right but you didn't know how to exercise it, then that right's not available to you. All right, now just add that to 1,999 more, and that'll tell you the story, that your 1,100 rights are available to you if you can claim them. If you don't know what they are, they're not available to you. Right, so that's a very important point as a matter of law. It works that way all over the world. In Anglo-Saxon administration, works that way in the Roman civil law. It's been that way for thousands of years. So in short, people who have rights, you know, you Australians and New Zealanders, you have rights, but you don't know what they are and you don't know how to use them. So for practical purposes, you're no better off than a slave working in some coal mine someplace. You're no better off than some Chinese coolie who's being oppressed in a gulag someplace. That doesn't give you any more benefits. That's why the creator of the universe told you that what you need in life is a legal education. And that's what we here at the law school do. We provide legal educations for Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives. Just everyday, ordinary, garden variety people. Not for the purpose of arming you with Uzi submachine guns or your own private homemade machine guns. We already have a law that says thou shalt not kill. There's no need or purpose for you to have a machine gun, but there may be a purpose in you knowing how to face, confront, cross-examine witnesses that are being brought against you. Hey, we got to give you a reminder here at the halfway point so that we can satisfy all the FCCs and government agencies around the world here as it relates to broadcasting and so on, and remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we are heard in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio worldwide. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law. From the scriptural perspective, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. However, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program They're mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, and the phone here is 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about property. Specifically, property is the holy grail of law. All right, now, I'll tell you a little story here as it relates to weeds. There was a story came out of Springfield, Massachusetts some years back, went to the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems that a man had a lot next to his house, and on the lot, it had grown up in weeds. You know how that is. You know, the weeds grow up, and, you know, if the guy's like I am and he's as lazy as I am, well, he didn't cut his weeds. Now, a lot of cities, a lot of towns will have weed abatement ordinances. And the city council, you know, under pressure from the citizens, they say, hey, listen, you know, we cut our weeds down, and then this guy over here, he's got these weeds growing, and they go to seed, and the seed blows all over, and then it makes dandelions in my lawn, and I don't like that. And I want a weed abatement ordinance. And so the city council passes a law. They call it a city ordinance here in this country. And it says, thou shalt cut thy weeds. Now, if you don't cut your weeds, they have to have a penalty. And so they come along with the weed police, and they cut your lawn for you. See, they cut your weeds down. And then they put a lien on your property and add it to your property taxes. And here in our state, Missouri, we have a noxious weed. It's called multifloral rose. Multifloral rose. We don't like it. It's a stickery weed, you know. It's a bramble kind of a thing, you know. It's a big bush. And they grow up out in your pastures, and we cut them off. But see, they grow from the roots. And to get rid of them, you got to go out and you got to hit them with some kind of weed killer, or you got to pull the roots out, and it's really a real pain in the butt. Now, most of us lazy guys like me, we just cut them off with a brush hog, and then they grow up and we cut them off with the brush hog, but they keep spreading. And so actually they're illegal. And if you know, they were to get obnoxious with you, this is, you know, the weed police, they could come out here and kill those for you and then send you a bill. They do that once in a while. They get kind of rowdy and come out and do things like that. Well, anyway, here's this guy's in Springfield, Massachusetts, and the weed police come out there, and they cut his weeds off, and they go in, and they put a lien on his property. Worse yet, they gave him a ticket, charged him criminally. They got to fine him. And, you know, sometimes, you know, if they fine you and you don't pay the fine, well, then maybe you got to go to jail for a week or 10 days or 30 days or something like that, you know. And so in this country, you have to have what we call a damage in order to have standing in court, and it comes under Ashwander versus TVA. So you can't just walk into court and go sue people. You have to have what's called standing, which means you have to have a vital controversy at issue. So when you suffer a damage, that is, they give you a ticket or they lock you up in jail or do something like that, now you're damaged, and now you've got standing, and now with standing, we can take this into the adjudicatory process and we can get a decision made, a policy. Now, most people don't want to do that. And so when they get a ticket, they just shut up and go down and pay the money. So the government learns after a while that since 99% of people don't know what the laws are and don't know what the rights are and couldn't tell the difference between property and commerce, that it's a hell of a neat way to tax people. So they just make laws, and then they hire people to go out and enforce those laws, and then the people that they're enforcing the laws just come in, plead guilty, pay the fine, and walk out the door. And so what this does is it encourages public officials to make more laws, hire more people, to go out and find more people, to create more taxes so that they can hire more people and create more laws so that they can find more people and raise more money to hire more people to make more laws, and it just goes on and on and on. We call it the law enforcement growth industry. That's why we have 2.5 million laws here in this country, 2.5 million laws. And it's growing at the rate of 47 pages a day. It's law enforcement growth industry. It's just law gone wild. And most of these laws apply to people under regulation and commerce. They don't apply to people that deal with the Ten Commandment model and property. And in some cases, they don't even apply to people that are commercial people under regulation. All right, now let's understand something. A law can be illegal, unlawful, or unconstitutional on its face. And city councils go out and make these laws, and state governments make these laws just by the bushel baskets, and they're just absolutely unconstitutional and illegal. Let me give you an illustration. In this country, we used to have a process, a law here, called vagrancy. And they'd go out and they'd ask you, how much money have you got? And you'd say, well, I don't have any money. Oh, my God, you're a vagrant. You're under arrest, and they take you to jail. So if you're a poor person and you don't have any money, you're a criminal. They lock you up. Okay. Well, in 1964, somebody took it to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court struck that vagrancy provision down as being unconstitutional. But that doesn't mean that cities and counties and states have to take it off the books. It just means that anybody that knows that the law is unconstitutional uses that as an affirmative defense, and the case will be dismissed. But 99% of you people don't know that. So let's try it. And they go out and they arrest you for vagrancy, and you come in. The judge says, well, how do you plead to this charge of being a vagrant? And 99% of people, not knowing that the law is unconstitutional and that it was actually struck down, would say, well, let's see, the law says you got to have $5. I didn't have $5, so I guess I'm guilty, judge. And the judge says, okay, I'll accept your guilty plea, and then I'm going to fine you $25. Well, hell, your problem was you didn't have $5. If you didn't have $5, what in hell is going to make you have $25? But now you've been in jail for 10 days. And then the judge says, I'm going to fine you $25 and give you credit for time served. Dismissed. And so they let you go. Now, you can't sue them. It actually is false arrest and false imprisonment. But you can't sue anybody because you agreed that you were, in fact, a vagrant. Right. We have one more. Let me give you another example. Identification, identifying yourself. Here in the United States, we have 50 states. 24 of the states have identification laws, and 26 states don't. It's about 50-50, about half and half. Well, what that means is that when the policeman comes up to you and says, all right, give me some identification. Well, hell, 99.99% of people reach in their pocket and pull out a wallet and give them their driver's license or social security number or state ID or something, a credit card, and the policeman says, oh, okay, now I know who you are. I've got your identification and blah, blah, blah. And then he talks to you and then you go about your business. Now, there are some people, not many, but there are some people that tell the policeman to kiss off, like federal judges, you know, one, Lawson, in Lawson versus Colander, and others, you know, Brown v. Texas. And so then they get arrested and they're taken to jail. Now, if you know how to defend, I mean, if you've got some education, some legal education, and you defend this correctly, and here's what Brown and Lawson did, we find out that you do not have to identify yourself to the policeman. Okay? There's another case called Heibel versus Nevada, which is an exception to that. It's a distinguishing characteristic. When the policeman's called out on a call, then you have to give him your name. You don't have to give him anything else, just your name. No identification. You just say, my name is Joe Sixpack. Okay? But, you know, even there's some exceptions to the rule. So the moral to the story is, those laws, Brown v. Texas, have been adjudicated by the courts. Now, most people don't know that. And California raises about $6 million a year by charging people for failing or refusing to identify themselves to the policeman, even though there are two cases, Lawson and Brown, which says you don't have to do that. Isn't that just special? Now, they don't take it off the books. Well, think about it. What if you had a product in your store which was patently illegal, and you're selling $6 million a year of this illegal product? Every once in a while, though, the police come in and they arrest you, seize the product, and charge you $500 fine. Would you remove that product from your shelves? I know some of you are saying, well, yeah, I'd remove it because I'm law-abiding, but hell, nobody in his right mind would. I mean, come on, wake up. You're selling $6 million worth of this illegal product. Once a year, the police come in, seize the product, cost you $1,000, fine you $500. So it cost you $1,500. Okay, well, but you're selling $6 million worth every year. We assume you're making a $3 million profit. Why would you throw a $3 million profit item off of your shelves and it will only cost you $1,500? That's like whores on Times Square in New York. They go out, look, whoredom and prostitution's illegal. These women make so much money practicing prostitution, once in a while they get caught. They're taken downtown and they're fined $1,500. They reach in their purse, they pay the $1,500 and go back to work. It doesn't do anything to dissuade the prostitution. Now, if you wanted to dissuade prostitution, you take the prostitute out and stone her to death at a lamppost in Times Square. I think that would have some effect, but not fining them $1,500. All right, so you're starting to get the drift of this. Now, going back to the guy in Springfield, Massachusetts, he's got this fine. He goes into court, and he says, this law is unconstitutional. It's constitutionally vague and ambiguous because it doesn't specify multiflora rose or Canadian star thistle. It just says weeds. What in the hell is a weed? I mean, I can go out into my wife's garden, her flower garden, and I look at my wife's garden, and I say, my God, look at all those weeds out there. She says, oh, no, those are beautiful flowers. I look at those, and I shake my head, and I say, and you went out there and sweated, and you worked, and you put out a lot of labor to put those weeds in the ground. But no. To her, those are beautiful flowers. All right? So this guy goes into court, and he says, and furthermore, I want damages from the city for coming in here and destroying my landscaping. You see, I spent a lot of money. Now, this is what this guy did. He produced witnesses to prove his point. You see, on his lot next door that the city claims is full of weeds, this guy goes over there with watering equipment and hoses and waters it. He's actually watering his weeds. Well, that's what you people call weeds. He calls it his natural landscape. Notice the words natural landscape. Now, out on the prairies of America, you know, out here in the high plains of Colorado and Kansas and so on, it's what we call the high plains. And we have native grasses out there. It's the native flora and fauna. Now, you know, most people would say, oh, my God, look at all those weeds out there. There's cacti and there's bushes and all kinds of stuff out there. And you say, hey, this is full of weeds. Well, then the next guy comes along and says, oh, no, that's the natural ecology. And then they fight about that in Congress and tax us all to preserve all these weeds out on the high plain. All right, so now look, if you go down to the garden store and you buy a multiflora rose and you take it in and you plant it in your garden, here in our state, we would call that a noxious weed. But hell, you might go down here and buy that same multiflora rose and plant it in your garden and call that a flower. See? And so the law has to be able to recognize weeds from flowers, or in this case, natural landscaping. Well, anyway, he was convicted at the lower level, and this is always disappointing. You know, when you go in here to the justice of the peace, and he says, well, I find you guilty. And so you appeal it by trial de novo to the district court, and he says, well, I affirm the justice of the peace's decision. So you appeal that up to your state court of appeals, and they say, well, we concur with the district court. And then you appeal it to your state supreme court, and they say, well, we affirm the decision of the appellate court. Now, you've lost four times in a row. Now, that's just got to be, you know, just downright disappointing, depressing. Can you imagine where Rosa Parks was? I mean, she lost at every level. It's kind of like George Washington. He was fighting the Revolutionary War. He only won one battle. One battle. He won the one battle that counted, Battle of Yorktown. That's the way life is, you know. And he fought a lot of battles and lost, and then finally he won one, and that was the one that won the war. Same thing happens here. Rosa Parks lost every battle and won the war. She only won in the one court that counted. That was the U.S. Supreme Court. That's the way this game is played. So this guy takes it up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he walks in and he says, now listen, I got a lot next to my house, and on my lot next to my house, I have natural landscaping. These people call them weeds. I call them flowers. I call it natural landscaping. I call it property. I call it mine. I water it. I take care of it. And these clowns come out here, and they just cut it all down. Let's test it this way. My wife has got all these weeds out there. I call them weeds. She calls them flowers. I call them weeds. I go out here with my lawnmower, and I cut down all of her flowers. Do you know what she says to me when I come in the house? I never have actually done that. I've just dreamed about it. But I have dreams in my dreams about taking my John Deere riding lawnmower and just cutting all of those weeds down to about three inches above the ground so they all blend in with the rest of the grass so it's all level and even. Because, you know, I'm a farmer, and I kind of like to see grass all at the same level. You know what my wife would do? Why, she would come unhinged and go ballistic. She might even go postal on it. That's the only thing that keeps me from doing it. Now, picture this. The court now has a decision they got to make. And there's nine guys sitting up here on the court, and they're sitting there saying, is this property or is this law for weeds constitutionally vague and ambiguous? Now, when something is vague and ambiguous, it's unconstitutional. And so the court comes back and says, you can't just go out here and call these weeds because that's a generic term. If there's some particular plant that you want to earmark, you can do that with specificity. The city could come in and say, you cannot have tulips, you cannot have irises, you cannot have multifloral rose. But you can't just come out here and say, this guy's got weeds. Because if you'll think about this, you know, some people go down and they spend good money to buy these weeds and they plant them in their yards. And they call that landscaping and pay a lot of money for it. Now, if it grows up naturally out here on the high plains, we just call that the natural ecology. If it's growing someplace where you didn't intend it, we call it a weed. But a weed now is vague and ambiguous. It's constitutionally impermissible. It's the point I'm making. Tuck it away in your heart now. Now, out in California, they got a thing out there called the star thistle, and so the legislature says, thou shalt not grow star thistles in your pasture. You got to get rid of those. Sometimes the government will come out and spray those for you and then send you the bill for it. If you don't spray them, if you don't dig them out or do something, see, they go to seed and then they spread over the fence to your neighbors. Now, if you could keep all those seeds over on your side of the fence, now that'd be another story. But you can become a noxious pest yourself, you know, if your seeds are blowing around the neighborhood. And that's the problem with GMOs. See, the pollen from this GMO blows across the fence. The bees, you know, take it over to your neighbors, and then they screw up his crops. And so now you're interfering with somebody else's property rights. And any time that you're messing with somebody else's property rights, if that guy is smart enough to walk into court and say, hey, wait a minute, property here, that's what the judge is trained to look for. He's looking for property and property rights. And when you walk in and make this property claim, the burden of proof is on you. You have to prove that this is property. And so this guy walks in and says, hey, this is property. The evidence is the pictures. He's got pictures of his natural landscaping. He's out there with hoses and watering equipment. He's watering his natural landscaping. And here comes the city in and cuts it down and sends him a bill. And he comes back and says, hey, wait a minute. I'm not only not going to pay you this bill for cutting down my natural landscaping, I'm going to sue you, City of Springfield, for having interfered with my property rights. Now, if the city comes along and says, thou shalt not have star thistles and multifloral rose, you better not have star thistles and multifloral rose in your natural landscaping. But if your city now has been careless, and they used a generic term like weeds to describe multifloral rose and maybe orchids and other things that you may have planted among your natural landscape, now that's another story. You can't do that. And you know you can't do that in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, or any place else. And that's because law originally comes from either God at Mount Sinai or it comes from the Roman Empire. And if it's Roman law, which is what we're basically practicing worldwide today, the Romans, you know, have had a system that we have followed from that day to this. And the Apostle Paul was fully familiar with it, and he could practice it very, very well. And you can learn it, and you can practice it very well also. You can also practice the property laws of the Ten Commandment model, and you can learn how to do that wherever you live. You can do it under the United Nations Charter. You can do it under the Constitution of your country. You can do it under the Constitution and laws of the United States. You need to learn how. You need to learn the principles of law. You've got a right to face, confront, cross-examine your accusers in Australia, just like we do here in the United States. But, you know, most people in the United States don't know how to do it either. And so, of the 1,100 rights that we have, they're not available to us because we can't claim them. We don't know what they are. So now, if you're of a mind to learn what your rights are and then how to use them, and I'm not even suggesting that you memorize 1,100 rights. What I'm suggesting is that you learn law. And then, when an issue comes up, you ask yourself, gee, do I have a right involved here? And then, based upon those facts, you look it up, you research it out, and you say, oh my God, look at that, I have a right to natural landscaping. Hey, I've got a right to natural landscaping. I've got a right to this mold of floral rose. And these clowns came in here and took it. Hey, I got a right to night soil. They're accusing me of having sewage. I don't have any sewage. I've got night soil. And I've got a right to night soil. And look at what they're doing here. They're coming in here falsely accusing me. That's the point. And once you're able to do that, and all of a sudden your life takes on new meaning. All of a sudden, hey, wait a minute, that Mountie up there is not an enemy at all. He's just an uninformed government employee that needs to be put in his place. That policeman over there, he's just an uninformed fellow that needs to learn some law. Let's go teach him some law here in court. Judges now like to teach law to policemen, just like they like to teach law to defendants. Hey, I'm about out of time here again, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by pre-arrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.